Tastepool.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club radio program, America's longest-running radio show. I am Gloria Duffy, president and CEO of the club, a nonpartisan, nonprofit civic forum that's brought people together to explore important topics for 120 years. Thanks so much for joining us today. Journalist Jonathan Karl has known Donald Trump since his days as a New York Post reporter in the 1990s. He covered every day of Trump's administration as ABC News' chief White House correspondent. He's also the author of the new book, Tired of Winning, Donald Trump and the End of the Grand Old Party, in which he shares the inside story of Trump's post-presidency and how he has changed the GOP. To discuss these issues with Karl today is another journalist, Jonathan Swan, a political reporter for the New York Times. Before we get to their conversation, we're going to play a selection of Jonathan Karl reading from his book. Let's listen in.
"25 years before my first book about Donald Trump was published, I wrote a paperback entitled The Right to Bear Arms, The Rise of America's New Militias. My first book, written in the wake of Timothy McVeigh's 1995 bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, tracked the emerging anti-government movement that inspired McVeigh to make war on federal law enforcement agencies that he and many other far-right activists believed posed a threat to America and to themselves. On the cover of the book is a photograph of a building engulfed in flames. It was the Branch Davidians compound called Mount Carmel in Waco, Texas. Federal law enforcement had learned the group was stockpiling weapons and explosives, and after a disastrous 51-day siege in early 1993, attempted to storm the compound. With agents closing in, several Branch Davidians sent fire to the building, apparently preferring to die rather than being captured by authorities. The body of the cult's leader, David Koresh, was found with a gunshot to the head. Investigators concluded he was killed by one of his deputies. The episode was widely considered a colossal failure by the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which coordinated the assault. To some, though, the debacle represented something far more sinister than a federal raid gone horribly wrong. They saw it as a deliberate plot by the FBI and the ATF to trap and murder the Branch Davidians. The Right to Bear Arms tracks how the Waco siege became a rallying cry for a national movement of mostly right-wing activists who believed Washington, D.C. was dangerously corrupt and out to get them. Forming what they called citizens' militias, they stockpiled arms and ammunition as well as food and survival gear. Some of them played weekend war games, practicing makeshift military maneuvers in vacant parking lots, on farmland, or in remote woodlands. I interviewed members of these groups. I read their writings, listened to their talk shows on shortwave radio, and attended some of their meetings. The ranks of the militias are made up of factory workers, veterans, computer programmers, farmers, housewives, small business owners, I wrote in the book's introduction. The most shocking thing about these, quote, paramilitary extremists is how normal they are. They are your neighbors. But in another sense, many of America's new militias live in a parallel universe where civil war is already being waged by tyrants within the federal government. On the furthest fringes of this movement were individuals who wanted to take revenge on the federal agencies responsible for not only the siege in Waco, but a host of other transgressions, both real and imagined. McVeigh, for example, cited the government's, quote, increasingly militaristic and violent actions as his rationale in a letter he wrote to Fox News correspondent Rita Cosby weeks before he was executed under the federal death penalty. In that letter, McVeigh argued that his bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, at the time the deadliest domestic terrorist attack in American history, was, quote, morally and strategically equivalent to the U.S. military striking government buildings in countries around the world. But McVeigh was an exception that proved the rule. For the most part, the members of these citizens' militias I encountered condemned the Oklahoma City bombing. They weren't terrorists. They were ordinary Americans who had grown increasingly paranoid. Their mantra is self-defense, I wrote in 1995. They have formed not to wage a campaign of terror, but to defend themselves from a terror campaign they believe is already being waged by their own federal government. In the run-up to my book's publication, I planned a small party for friends and family at the Heartland Brewery in Manhattan and decided to spruce up the party invite with some over-the-top words of praise from my friends and colleagues. A couple of my fellow reporters at the New York Post offered up some choice words, and on a whim, I decided to call a famous New Yorker who was both a reliable source and known for making hyperbolic statements to see if he would give me a quote as well. My source readily agreed to provide a glowing endorsement of the book, provided that I wrote it myself. So I did. "What a book! Carl is one of the best in the business. Tough, fair, and brutally honest. Donald J. Trump." Trump signed off on that quote. To this day, I don't know whether he actually read the advance copy of The Right to Bear Arms that I had sent him, but more than a quarter of a century later, he announced that the first rally of his 2024 presidential campaign would be held in a familiar location, Waco, Texas.
That was Jonathan Carl reading from his new book about Donald Trump. Now, here's his conversation with fellow journalist Jonathan Swan.
Hello, welcome to today's virtual Commonwealth Club program. My name's Jonathan Swan, political reporter for the New York Times. It's my pleasure to introduce Jonathan Carl, chief Washington correspondent for ABC News, co-anchor of This Week with George Stephanopoulos, and author of the new book, Tired of Winning, Donald Trump and the End of the Grand Old Party. Jonathan has known Donald Trump longer than any other White House correspondent and covered his historic rise as president, as well as the political and legal aftermath from the 2020 election. Jonathan, I want to start with reading a message from Donald Trump about you.
Okay, good.
It's dated November the 15th, so it's about a month ago. Failed ABC fake news reporter Jonathan Carl just wrote another bad book. He works so hard, three O's on so, but has so little talent. Some people have it and some people don't. I'm not going to read the rest of the message, but of all the things in your book, and you really catalogue Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the election, explicit sort of flirtations with Confederate imagery and iconography, vengeance. What was the thing that really bothered him most about your book?
The book is a grim portrayal. I think it's a very fair portrayal because it is based on the facts. Almost all of what is in there is derived from information that I received talking to people who served him, people that were close to him. I mean, virtually every source in that book is a Republican, most of them Republicans who at one point or another, and some cases still do, support Donald Trump. It wasn't the fact that I talked about how the first campaign rally of his campaign was in Waco, Texas, that it was using language from the militia movement that inspired Timothy McVeigh to drive a truck full of explosives to blow up the federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing 168 people. It wasn't talking about one of his top outside advisors invoking the Confederate plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln to describe the theme of Trump's 2024 campaign. It wasn't any of that. It was something I reported about Kim Kardashian. Seriously, that is the one thing that Trump has taken issue with in this book. The one and only thing that he has taken issue is some reporting in the book about Kim Kardashian, which, by the way, he doesn't actually dispute. He just wants to dispel me of the idea that he would ever do anything because Kim Kardashian wanted him to do something. He would listen to Kanye West, but he wouldn't listen to Kim Kardashian.
And I thought it was quite revealing that the thing that bothered him was the implication that sports stars didn't want to come to the White House, that this was the thing that got under his skin.
And by the way, I mean, this is not like a major thing in the book, but it's a very interesting and revealing anecdote. This is at the end. January 6th happens. If you remember Bill Belichick, he had given the Medal of Freedom and Belichick was supposed to be coming to the White House to accept it, the great Patriots head coach, and Belichick canceled on him. Too toxic, put out a statement saying the country is too divided. I'm not going to come to the White House. So Trump being desperate to show up Belichick, Kim Kardashian had reached out to him seeking clemency for a list of people. You know, she, of course, was very involved in getting the pardon for Alice Johnson. She's somebody who's taken on this criminal justice reform. And his answer to her was, well, you get me some of your football player friends to the White House and I'll do something, but you got to get me that. And she actually tried to do it. And none of them would come. That's how toxic Trump was in the final 2 weeks of his presidency.
You wrote two books on Trump before this. Both were bestsellers. The second one was very dark for obvious reasons. It catalogued his efforts to overturn the election, the period that led up to and followed January 6th. What was the origin story of this book? Did you always have a thought that you would do a third one? How did you come to do this book?
When I wrote Betrayal, my previous book, I really did think that would be the last thing I would ever write about Donald Trump. So this was not something I immediately planned. In fact, Betrayal, the subtitle is The Final Act of the Trump Show. And I wrote that book because I wanted to get down for history exactly what had happened in the lead up to January 6th. I wanted to get down to the best I can while memories were fresh, go and talk to everybody who was there and tell the story of 2020, the election, the COVID disaster, and how it all culminated in January 6th. So I thought that was the end. And then sometime in 2021, I decided that there's another story to write, but it's not the story that I ended up writing. My original idea was to essentially describe the sad and lonely demise of a disgraced ex-president, what it was like to go back, to lose all of that power, to be an outcast from his party and from his former friends. And I interviewed him a couple of times over the course of 2021. And the last interview was really for kind of the very end before Betrayal went to press. And, you know, it just struck me that was kind of your story. What's it like to have exile in Mar-a-Lago, this glorious exile where he's playing DJ on the patio out back and anybody that was with him in the White House has basically flown the coup. You know, not even his family seems to want to have much to do with him. And then, you know, Jonathan, as I'm writing the story, he recaptures the mantle of the Republican Party. He becomes the dominant figure, the presumptive front runner for the Republican presidential nomination once again. So it became a very different story. I had toyed with the idea of calling the book The Biggest Loser. There's a chapter called The Biggest Loser about the 2022 elections, but it became a very different story. And where Betrayal was to try to get the history down, this one, to a degree, is more forward-looking, even though it describes in detail what happened to get us here. It's a warning about what could be coming if he returns to power.
Just to stay with that, it's funny, it struck me reading the book, it's hard to remember just how much of a pariah Donald Trump was after January 6th, and really how the party, I talked to so many Republicans, I know you did too at that time, who felt that Donald Trump was over, it was behind us. Take us back to that period. I mean, you talked to Trump a couple of times, as you said, in 2021, and you did a lot of reporting. What was he thinking, doing, saying in that early period? Like, do you think he ever seriously entertained the idea of not running for president again?
He was obsessed with something else. So I don't think that running again was what was motivating him, what he was doing during this very dark period. I've got a chapter called Dark Days in Mar-a-Lago that describes what life was like around him during this period. Sure, he had Kevin McCarthy come to visit him famously on January 28th. But even that, McCarthy was very quick to tell people that he was in Florida doing fundraising and he just stopped by, or as Liz Cheney is now reporting, people had said he's not eating.
Right.
I didn't have that detail, although I did have a story of him getting up and leaving dinner in the middle of dinner, again, out in the patio of Mar-a-Lago. And just everybody's like, what happened? He just left. So he was out of sorts, but he became obsessed over the course of 2021 with the idea that he could actually be reinstated as president, not by winning the next presidential election, And your colleague Maggie Haberman had tweeted something about this at the time, sometime during, I believe it was the summer, that this has been something that he had been thinking about. I don't think anybody took it too seriously. I learned that it was a total obsession with him. He wasn't saying hardly anything about it publicly except for a few cryptic statements, but privately, it was all he wanted to talk about, to the point where one person close to him at Mar-a-Lago said, look, you've got to stop talking about that because people are going to think you're crazy. And I think he had just lost touch with reality. This was a QAnon, you know, Mike Lindell. Right. Remember, he floated the idea he's going to be reinstated on August 13th. Well, Trump was all in on this thing. And he was in on it long after it didn't happen on August 13th. He was still pushing it into last year.
What was his conception of how this would actually work?
Yeah, it was kind of a domino theory. It really started with the cyber ninjas, as you recall, they hired to do the recounts, an additional audit out in Arizona. Yeah. The Arizona Senate Republicans hired this firm that had never done anything like it. Remember, it was a whole sideshow that lasted for months. And OAN, the far right, I don't want to call them a news channel, but the far right, whatever you want to call it, television network, had gotten the rights to do a closed circuit broadcast of the recount, like 24/7. And Trump was watching this thing from his office at Mar-a-Lago. He was talking about it to people who would come, you know. One of the ways you got information about Trump during this time period, besides talking to people, because he had no access to Twitter, he wasn't being interviewed by anybody, he wasn't out there doing public events for the most part, is people would have weddings or events at Mar-a-Lago, and he would come out and speak to the crowd, and people would take video with their cell phones and then post it. And sometimes he spoke at length, and he was forever talking about this thing going on in Arizona. But his idea was that the cyber ninjas would prove that Arizona was in fact a total landslide for Trump. And then that would prompt either Georgia or Michigan or Pennsylvania, didn't matter which, maybe Wisconsin, to do the same thing. And then that would prove that he had really won each one of those states. And then the evidence would be so overwhelming that somehow it would force, hard to know exactly how, the Supreme Court was sometimes invoked,
right,
as if the Supreme Court was going to say, wait a minute, Biden out, you know. But this was the thinking. And I asked him about it in July. It was July 23rd of 2021. So we're just a few weeks away from the August 13 date that Lindell was talking about. And I only asked him because I had called him up to go over some of the things that I was reporting on to kind of check with him. I always would do that. And he was ranting about, you're seeing all this stuff and you're not going to write about it. You're not going to believe all this stuff that's coming out and people are going to see. And he had had a statement, which I'm sure you will recall, but most people won't, that had come out just a few days before, that was ranting about SNL. It was a rant. Back then, his statements, nobody saw because he didn't even have Truth Social yet. I mean, he was truly, like you said, a guy that was a pariah. He had his website and they would put out statements and, you know, most people didn't see them, but it ended with the phrase 2024 or before.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Gratuitously, right, just at the end.
Right.
So I wasn't even going to ask him about it, but then I was like, well, you don't really think you can be reinstated, do you, before the next election? And he tells me, and it's quite, I mean, I don't know if it's sad or if it's comical or if it's nuts, but he says, you know, I would tell you, but you wouldn't understand. You wouldn't understand it. You know, he was really fixated on this. And as you know, there's something else in the book that I describe, which is Mo Brooks, one of the most hardcore pro-Trump figures in Congress by far, the guy that wore body armor to his rally on January 6th, the guy that there was a move to strip his committee assignments because his rhetoric was so incendiary on January 6th. Trump asked Mo Brooks in early 2022, early last year, to make a public statement calling on his reinstatement as president. And Mo Brooks refused to do it. Even Mo Brooks right, thought that was a little nuts.
So Trump is quite isolated in that period. He's spending a lot of time talking to people like Boris Epstein, Mike Lindell, the sort of the Stop the Steal crowd. But there were some rehabilitators from the Republican Party at its highest levels. And you chronicle that. Talk about that, because it is an interesting sort of thought experiment to think about, well, was it destined that Donald Trump, was it always going to happen, or were there these moments that enabled him to come back as the dominant figure? Of course, we'll never know, and you say that in your book, but talk us through that part of the story.
Well, you're right. To come back to how you started this discussion, people have forgotten, or perhaps weren't even fully aware, because he was truly out of the imagination. But it was like he was pushed aside, how much of a pariah he was. And I think there are two very critical moments, two very critical what-ifs. The first is the chairwoman of the Republican Party, Ronna McDaniel, who, as I had recounted in Betrayal, had called him on January 20th, 2021, when Trump was getting on Air Force One for his last ride aboard Air Force One to go home. He left the White House, I think it was about 8:30 in the morning, didn't stick around for the inauguration, didn't want to have any contact with Biden whatsoever. He leaves, has a really pathetically small rally at Andrews Air Force Base, goes up the steps. Ronna McDaniel, who like so many others didn't go, calls him up just to say, hey, thanks for all you did. We accomplished a lot. You know, just a nice farewell call. And he lays into her, puts the phone on speakerphone. Don Jr. is there in that office in front of Air Force One. And he tells her that he's leaving the Republican Party. Now, there had been reporting on this at the time that Trump was talking about forming a Patriot Party and all this. And you don't know how much of this to take seriously. I mean, at the time, I didn't really think that much of it. But what I learned, very thoroughly reported, is that he said point blank he was going to leave, and that McDaniel was really beside herself and said, if you do that, you're going to hurt all the people that did so much for you, worked so hard for you. You won't win. We won't win. We'll all lose. He snaps at her and says, you deserve to lose because you, meaning the Republicans, didn't work hard enough. If you had, I'd still be president. And McDaniel goes from pleading with him, pleading to his kind heart and his loyalty to those that have been so loyal to him. That doesn't work. So she basically threatens him. And there's some negotiations that go back and forth for 4 or 5 days. And he backs down. He stays in the Republican Party. So that's one.
But just what before you move happened, on, the substance of the threat is actually really important.
It was money. It was money. There were two aspects of it. One, as you recall, the RNC was paying some of his legal bills. So obviously that wasn't going to go away, which she reminded him. But the thing that he had used to make most of his money from the political world was the massive database mailing list of Trump voters, Republican voters. And the way you make money off that is you rent it to other campaigns. So every, you know, House candidate, Senate candidate, you can rent parts of the list from your district, from your state. And he made a lot of money renting that thing out. And the RNC allowed him to be the one that rented it out. So they said that they were going to make it publicly available for free, which meant nobody would pay a dime anymore to rent it out. And he would lose his primary source at that point of income. So it was money. It was money. And he backed down. What if she, at that point, had said, go ahead, start your own party? It's hard to think about it now from a perspective where he's, once again, the dominant figure, maybe as much a hold on the party as ever. To that moment, I mean, who would have gone with him? Certainly he would have had his core supporters. Would he really have done it? He was from such a weak point. Would he really have followed through on the threat? Who knows? But, it, you know, she could have called his bluff on that. And the other is McCarthy. And McCarthy, who had very little regard for him at this point and certainly didn't think he was going to be, you know, reemerging the way he has. But McCarthy had two things that he was thinking about. One, you know, obviously he was thinking about becoming Speaker of the House and knew that if Trump, even in a weakened pariah state, was not supportive, that would be problematic. But more importantly, he's looking to the midterm elections and thinking that Republicans need a big turnout to win back the House. And if Trump is not fully on board, you know, his people aren't going to be turning out. And he's also thinking of, you know, the help that Trump can provide raising small donor money. So, you know, he's thinking just not that I need to pay allegiance to Trump and invite him back in to be the leader of the party again, but we need to have him part of the team if I'm going to be successful going into the midterms and if I'm going to be successful after we win the House in becoming Speaker. So what if McCarthy had just blown him off and just ignored him? I mean, McConnell had done that. I mean, McConnell had said, you know, the criminal justice system can deal with him now. So those are two key what-if moments, I think, for the Republican Party. Now, maybe McDaniel would have been, you know, cast aside, mm-hmm. and maybe McCarthy's career would have been over and he never would have been Speaker. I don't know. I mean, that Speaker thing didn't work out that great for him anyway.
You don't think so?
At those 2022 elections, I don't know that Trump was that great a force for them. Do you think so? I mean, what a disaster. What if at that moment, just rip off the Band-Aid and say, you know what? Thanks. Goodbye.
What's really interesting about that, just listening to you talk about that and reading in the book, is there's sort of two elements to it. There's fear. They still feared what he could do. But there was also complacency. And these people, and it wasn't just those two. It was, I think, I talked to a lot of different Republican members of Congress, senators, et cetera, party leaders. They all were operating under the assumption that Donald Trump would never have a chance of being the nominee of the party ever again, that his political days
were... Oh my God, it was just
accepted wisdom. And they were operating with that as the baseline, and everything was premised with that as the baseline. You know, another counterfactual I've been thinking about a lot recently, you know, is McConnell. I mean, I just wonder, we may never exactly know the real truth about what he thinks, but I do wonder the extent to which he's now second-guessing his impeachment vote. Votes like that could have also changed history.
You know, it was the New York Times, I believe, that kind of jolted the political world with a story as the impeachment trial was approaching. That he was seriously considering voting guilty. And I'm sure you were doing the same thing. I remember getting out my list and counting Republicans and seeing you needed 17 mm-hmm. to vote guilty. And I could just about get there. You know, if McConnell wins, you had these institutionalists who would have been largely with McConnell.
Right.
I mean, it was very hard. It was very close. But I obviously, once McConnell takes his stand, there's no way that the Thunes and the Cornyns and the Grassleys and those kind of people are going to vote guilty while McConnell is voting not guilty. But yeah, I think that's a great question too. Again, because what could have come with a guilty verdict is a prohibition on running ever again for public office.
So we fast forward. He does run for president. One of the core themes of your book is retribution as a motivating force. And I think it's spot on. I think it really is a deep, deep motivating force. He's not making a secret about it. He said it out loud. But just talk about how that desire for retribution has colored his thinking as he runs for president a third time.
So he announced that he was running for president on November 15th of last year, 2022. It was just a week after Republicans had that horribly disappointing midterm elections. And everybody around him, with the exception of just a couple of people, were urging him not to announce he was running. It's like, you can run, but just don't announce now. This is a very bad time. Let the dust settle, you know, wait. And he goes forward with the announcement and he gives a speech at Mar-a-Lago. I was there. One of the many things striking about this announcement in the ballroom at Mar-a-Lago was how few people were there. The seats were all filled, but there were none of the people that you think of as the Trump brain trust, you know, the key figures from his White House, the key figures from his 2016 or 2020 campaign. None of them were there. None of the campaign managers, none of the chiefs of staff, not a single confirmed cabinet member. There were only two members of Congress who even bothered to show up. And one of them was Madison Cawthorn, who was about to become a non-member because he had lost a Republican primary. I mean, it was like nobody wanted anything to do with it, but he gave a speech. Which, and I remember Jason Miller being rather proud of the fact that the speech was not going to be a grievance tour of 2020. remember the discussion of the midterms was all this talk about stolen election is what dragged Republicans. And he didn't get into that in that speech. It was a kind of a policy speech.
He looked bored as he was.
He hated it. It was just terrible. And there was no talk of retribution. It was like, you know, we're going to go back and we're going to really drain the swamp this time. And, you know, I mean, it was just
energy independent.
Yeah. And if you remember, for the next couple of months, almost a full couple of months, if you looked at the polls, it was Ron DeSantis that was on top in a hypothetical matchup because DeSantis hadn't declared he was running yet. There was a Wall Street Journal poll in